me take care of some logistics while Fred works his magic here. First of all, I want to let people know, especially in Redmond, we have the homework here. I asked people who sent things in electronically to let us know where to return them, and we didn't get much of a response, and decided the best way logistically to handle things was the homeworks are here right now. I am going to take them with me. Anything that's not picked up, I'm going to take with me tonight, and I'll be in Redmond tomorrow. So there are some choices, and this is mostly for people in Redmond. You can either come by my office and pick them up, or you can tell me that you want me to just send them by IO mail, and you'll get them, I guess, Thursday. Or you could, they'll be in Redmond, and you can pick them up a week from today. Do people have any preferences you want to voice? How urgently do you want the homework? Do you want it to IO? Do you want to come by and pick it up? Do you care?
Where is your office?
I'm in building 113, three floors and a few feet up and a few feet north of where you are right now. Okay. So. Can you respond? Do you hear us?
Yes.
Okay. Do you see us?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to answer my question?
No.
Can we just get it next week?
That's fine. I'm perfectly. If you would like to see it sooner,
I'll bring it down next week. Any that's left over, that are left over.
Yeah,
I'll be there next week.
Yeah, or I may be. Yes. Certainly, next week is easy. If you're in a rush to get it sooner, then there are alternatives. I guess what I'll do it this way. Since you're not expressing a great desire to rush and get them back, I'm not going to put them in IO mail. Instead, what I'll do is I'll hold them in my office, I guess. And if anybody wants them, you can come on by, send me an email, call to see if I'm there, you know, whatever, and we'll take care of that. Okay. The other bit of logistics I need to take care of is the mailing list.
So a quick update on that. I just updated everyone's emails in there. It should be sent to either your cs.washington address or your u.washington address. Once you check those, if you have not received an email from me, my email, dive on the webpage, send it to me, and I'll add you to the list on whatever address you want.
Okay, did everybody get that? So if you want some other home address that's more convenient for you, we can get that added. But you have to, if you want that, send information to Kate, and her address is on the webpage. Right, any questions about that?
Quick question about administrative stuff. When are we going to make the decision on the final versus project?
I would think that in about 2 weeks or so might be the right timing. Sort of get a bit more flavor for the course, see if there are things that you would think might be good projects or possibilities or things that are coming later. See how you would think about an exam and then test. But there doesn't seem to be a reason to rush the decision right now. Mm-hmm.
What percentage of the score is the final assignment based on?
Oh, that's a good question. We have to decide that. I would guess.
Last time you did 60-40. Is that right?
I would guess something in the area of 30-ish% for the final. Might be as high as 40, might be as low as 25. We have to get together in our little cabal and decide this. Okay. Any general questions before we get into at least some new material? Okay. So let me sort of wrap around and give a sense of what we've done and where we're going. First week, I talked very high level about some public key techniques, what can be done. John talked about symmetric ciphers as opposed to the asymmetric ciphers that I did the first time. Symmetric stuff, more of the traditional stuff, a lot of the history. We're sort of spiraling down to more detail and more information about the tools we have available. And then for the next couple of weeks, Brian is going to start digging into protocols and how you actually use this stuff in practice. You know, what's actually going on, how you make secure connections, how you do authentication, how you do these things. So we need to build the tools, and Brian's going to have the advantage of being able to now to use the tools when we get to them. So John's been able to present a rich history of the symmetric stuff. Here is most of the history of asymmetric stuff. Pretty much one slide. You know, there's some more stuff. I could certainly go into more detail. But really, the field of asymmetric cryptography is 30 years old. A little bit of argument. Some people might claim it's 32 or so. Who knows? There are some disputes. But it certainly doesn't seem to go earlier than the 70s. It started off with a seminal paper by Whit Diffie and Marty Hellman, New Directions in Cryptography, where they introduced the whole idea of a one-way function, something that you can compute in one direction, but even if you're given the answer, you can't go backwards. And they showed how to use that to do a key exchange, how you could get two people who have not communicated before to exchange a key securely over a public channel. About a year and a half later, Ron Rivest, Ari Shamir, and Len Edelman took this and said, wow, this is great stuff. We'd really like to find a way to do even more with this. And they built the RSA cryptosystem, which is a one-way trapdoor function, which allows you to not have to agree on a key and work from there, but instead there's sort of a one-way path of, I look up your key, I send you something. Now, there are actually ways of doing something similar with Diffie-Hellman, but it's straightforward with RSA, and also you get digital signatures out of the mix. And that's really the essence of things.
Are you going to get a chance to discuss identity-based encryption at all?
We could. I honestly don't think there's a lot there. I don't know if people in Redmond heard the question about identity-based encryption. There's a lot of hype around identity-based encryption, so maybe it's worth a slide or two at some point.
It seems like it solves the problem of where central public key storage. You know?
It doesn't really solve any problems, actually.
well, I'm interested in knowing why. Okay. We're
getting ahead of things. Identity-based encryption is an interesting idea, and there are some applications. The basic idea, to take 30 seconds and just mention this, is that, I'm just going
to
mention this now since we're on this, is that your name or your identity in some way is your public key. The problem is, how can I get the private key associated with my name? I can't just sort of say, my name is this, therefore I know something that I wouldn't know if my name weren't this. The only way to make identity-based encryption work is if there's some master server out there that knows some sort of a master key and can dole out, this is your name, okay, here's the private key that goes with your name. Now this master server knows everything, can read everybody's mail, can impersonate anybody, has to be uber trusted.
And has to have a good way for you to authenticate yourself to it, otherwise it shouldn't be giving you the private key.
Right. And basically serves the role of a certificate authority for a traditional public key system with even more power. So, yes, there are some applications, but they're not as great as you might think. Okay. So, on to sort of the basics, and we'll delve more into some of the details and get into some nice counterintuitive applications of public key stuff. But I just want to spend the 2 or 3 minutes as a reminder of where we are. Both Diffie-Hellman, let me get a nice bright color here, Diffie-Hellman and RSA, although they achieve very different things, are based on the same thing here. They're based on the same fundamental equation, which you've seen over and over again, and you will be sick of, but you'll at least appreciate the importance of it soon. So, the basic things, a few slides of review. Diffie-Hellman is based on this X value here being the unknown. And with that unknown, it's the discrete log problem, believed to be hard to solve. here's the Diffie-Hellman protocol. I'm not going to go through it again, but it's in your slides for completeness.
Just quickly, is that supposed to say large integer or large prime?
Back here?
No. Under Alice and Bob.
Ah, this should, yes, I took an early slide. If you recall, I was messing with people. Yes, this and this should say prime. And I originally presented this as, does this work with an integer? And we corrected it and said, you can cheat if it's just an integer. It really should be a prime. That was actually in the coin flipping case. I'm going to change that. I'm confusing the coin flipping part with this. In this case, A and B do not have to be primes. So, erase. Let's see if that works. Come on, there. Erase. There's a dot that won't go away. Look at that little dot going across. Do you see that there? No, it's just on my screen, huh? Okay. Forget it. These do not have to be primes. It's typically the case in Diffie-Hellman that this n, the modulus, is a prime. It is typically the case, but it doesn't have to be. So I purposely kept it general. But no, the exponents do not have to be primes here. Sorry. The other part of this equation, where y is the unknown, is what's used for RSA. And solving for y is also believed to be hard, unless you know the factorization of n. When I present it in this way, it seems hard to believe that Diffie-Hellman, using this, never saw RSA. And they historically stumbled around it, they asked the question, but they never quite got there. And it was Rivesh-Amir and Edelman a year or so later who looked and said, wait a minute, if we twist it this way, it looks easy in retrospect, but it took them months to figure it out.
What does trapdoor mean?
Trapdoor, the intuition behind a trapdoor is it's one way, but there is a trick that you can use to go the other way. So it's one way normally, but there's a trap door, something that can be done to allow the function to be reversed. In this case, the trap door is knowledge of the factorization of n allows you to compute roots and allows you to solve for y in this equation.
Mm-hmm. I've always heard trap door explained as the same thing as a one way, because you can only go down a trap door, you can't go back up it.
That's not how it's used in crypto.
Okay.
In crypto, there's a one way.
Schneier talks about it that way, but maybe he's wrong.
Schneier is fussy at times, okay. Let's say. A one way function is one way. A one way trapdoor function is one way unless you have the trapdoor information which allows you to go back. That's the standard terminology and usage. Okay. And here, to conclude the review, is RSA. Again, we don't have to go through it again. Multiply two primes. Do root finding. Everything works. Okay. So I'm going to just get started here. I know we're going to break in a little while, but I don't want to break quite yet. I want to get going, and then we'll take a break, I promise. But I want to go in and give some details of RSA that we sort of left at the side of the road as we went whizzing by a couple weeks ago. So there are a couple of important things about RSA that I'm getting at right here. First of all, the thing that makes RSA work is this equation, that if you take y and you raise it to a certain power x mod n, you get y back. And that power is described here. As long as x has this property, that x mod p minus 1 q minus 1 equals 1. Okay? And there's the claim that Alice can easily find two integers, e and d, that have this property that e times d, they multiply together, take in mod p minus 1 q minus 1 equals 1.
But that's also one way in the sense that somebody figured out what E and D were, it wouldn't reveal anything about P and Q.
Actually, if you know E and D, you can compute P and Q from them quite easily, in fact. I won't go into that, but if you're interested, I can show you how later. Okay. So, here are some remaining issues that we have to deal with. Why is this first equation true under these circumstances? And how do you do this? How do you compute B and D that have this property? And we've touched on this some, but we're going to go into detail, get some completeness, get some understanding of how to work with this, how you could actually implement this for yourself if you ever wanted to or had to. And then we'll be in a position to start using it. So, I talked about Fermat's little theorem some last time. If P is prime, then x to the p minus 1 mod p equals 1. Okay? And as long as p is, as long as x is not a multiple of p. And another way of writing this, a way that's actually more useful for our purposes, is down here. X to the p mod p is equal to x mod p. This is just take this and multiply through by p. And now it's x to the p mod p equals p. And the nice thing about this, the form down here, is that this form also captures x equals 0. You can just test. Yeah, x to the 0 mod 0 does equal 0. Whereas here, if you plug in 0, it doesn't work. So this, the second form captures 0, captures all the cases. That's what's used in RSA, and that's very convenient. Okay, so I want to give you a proof that this is true. I've made this assertion. It's actually not that hard. There are elementary proofs. And it starts off with the binomial theorem. I'm not going to prove the binomial theorem to you, although that's also elementary, but this is something that you learned probably in high school, at least some forms of this, and use it, how to basically expand an exponentiation, how to expand x plus y squared, or something like that. So in general, x plus y to the p, you can just work out. Here's the coefficient of x to the p is 1, the coefficient of y to the p is 1, and the coefficients of the intervening terms are p choose whatever the exponent is for that term. Okay, does this look vaguely familiar, I hope? I imagine many people have used this before. And p choose I is p factorial over I factorial, p minus I factorial. Okay? So let's move on. Now, if p is prime, then p choose I mod p is always going to be 0 for I in this range. Why is that the case? Well, look here. P factorial is 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times dot 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 times p. Look in the denominator. Is there a p in the denominator? I is less than p by this. So it's 1 times 2 times 3 up to something less than p, and p minus I, since I is greater than 0, is also less than p. So there are no p's in the denominator. P is a prime number. It has no factors other than 1 in itself. You're going to get an integer out of this, and this is something that, you know, I'm assuming you can prove it in a lot of ways, but this is going to be an integer value. It's got to be a multiple of p, because there's a p up in the numerator, and there's nothing to cancel that p down in the denominator. And there's no way to break that p apart into little pieces that would be canceled in the denominator. So p choose I mod p is going to be 0 for all the p in this range, for all the I in this range. So what does this let us do? It actually lets us do something very nice that every high school student wishes for. X plus 1 to the p, when taken mod p, is just x to the p plus y to the p. The intermediate terms, all the middle terms, cancel out. They all have coefficients which are 0 mod p. And you can do what you really wanted to do in high school. It's just p distributes. Exponents distribute just like everything else distributes, right? Well, they do mod p. Okay. So now we've got this nice little equation. This is an important equation that we can work with. And we're going to use this to prove Fermat's little theorem. Okay? So here's the proof of Fermat's little theorem. And then do it.
Fermat have other theorems?
Fermat has many, many theorems.
Okay.
This is a little theorem because it's a small, little, but very important thing. But if I can prove it in about 10 minutes in a crypto course, it's not something that Fermat would consider a big theorem.
Okay. So I remember he had one that like took 200 pages or something.
Fermat's done much, much important work. Okay. We're going to do this in an unusual way. There are many proofs of Fermat's little theorem, but induction on X is a cute, short, little elementary proof. So, does everybody remember how to do an induction proof? You probably did them in high school occasionally, if you had a discrete math course or something. Best water I could find is just the yogurt cup, but it holds water, it works. Okay. So, induction on X. So how do we do induction? Well, remember what induction is. Induction feels like cheating in math. It feels a little bit like you want to prove something, so you assume it's true. Well, not quite. What you do with induction, the way to think of induction is like dominoes. Not playing dominoes, but stacking dominoes so that they all roll. Each case in induction is like one domino. And what you do is you prove that if domino I falls, it will push over domino I plus 1. So you're proving that all the dominoes are lined up so that each one falling will cause the next one to fall. And then you go over to the beginning and you prove that the first domino is pushed over. And that causes all the dominoes to fall, and therefore it's true everywhere. Okay? So that's the base, the first domino falling is the base case of induction. And this is pretty simple. For x equals 0. If x is 0, then x to the p mod p is 0 to the p mod p, which is 0, which is what we're trying to show. X to the p mod p does indeed equal x mod p. Now, many people like to, for pedantic reasons, and there are some cases where you actually need it, show a base case beyond the first, show a second, and that's also easy in this case, so it might as well for completeness. For the x equal 1 case, again, I could do without it, but for x equal 1, again, x to the p is 1 to the p, it's just 1, which is equal to 1. So both of these base cases were trivial. Okay? So let's do the induction and make it work. So here's the inductive step. Assume that x to the p mod p equals x mod p. Now here's where it sounds like, wait a minute, isn't that what we're trying to prove? We're assuming it? Okay, what I'm trying to show is that if that's true, then x plus 1 to the p mod p equals x to the p plus 1 to the p. Basically, I'm adding 1, I'm replacing x by x plus 1 in both of these cases. So I want to prove that x plus 1 to the p mod p is going to equal x plus 1 mod p. That all squeezed on there. And this is the domino step, that this implies that. So if it's true for a certain value of x, then it's true for the next value of x, meaning the x plus 1.
What? P into the side of the second.
Okay, so I as I was going through the slides, I started describing it one way, but I had written it another way. So what you want to prove is that this implies what I wrote up here. Okay? That's what I want to approve. That if it's true for the case of a certain value of x, then it's true for the next value of x. Now, I'm proving it by starting out with, well, let's take a look at the left side of this equation here. What does x plus 1 to the p mod p x plus 1 to the p mod p by what we did before, that nice little trick of mod p, you can just distribute the exponent inside, is equal to x to the p plus 1 to the p mod p. Okay? That's what we just proved just a moment ago. Now, from there, we can say, well, this is equal to, what is x to the p? X to the p mod p, and remember you did on the homework, you can move mods inside all you want as long as you're taking mod p at the end. So x to the p mod p is just x mod p. So here's x. 1 to the p is just 1. You don't even have to do a mod on that, so you get that. And voila! I've shown that x plus 1 to the p power equals x plus 1. All when taking mod p. It feels like a little bit of magic, right? It feels like I didn't actually do anything, but that's a proof. I completed the whole proof. Okay. X to the p mod p does indeed equal x mod p for all integers. For integers x equals 0, that's wrong. For all integers x, that's supposed to be greater than or equal to 0. Sorry.
Oh, it's true.
Yes, it is. Trivially, uninterestingly, wasting a lot of slides, true. Okay, that should be greater than or equal to 0. Sorry. Okay. So, it's also true for negative values of x. You can just look what happens if you try negative x now. If x is positive, well, take a look at negative x. Negative x to the p is just negative 1 to the p times x to the p. Negative 1 to the p, if p is odd, as it is for most primes, is just negative 1 times x to the p here, and the negative factors out just the way you would hope. And of course, for the p equal 2, you can do it separately because negative x actually equals x when p is 2. But you don't need to go into that detail. Okay, so just a couple more minutes and then we'll take our break. So, we want to prove that RSA works. So we've shown, and I apologize for all these slides. I want to have nice slow reveals. Yeah, I had to deconstruct them to separate slides. We've shown that this equation is true. This is supposed to be less than or equal. I wonder if this is a case of a symbol not showing up properly.
That's correct.
In the printout, it's PowerPoint. Right.
Oh.
PowerPoint. But maybe not the presenter version.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
A bug.
Yeah, I'd say it's a bug.
Could the presenter version be from an older version of your PowerPoint?
We only set one in.
Yeah, this we're using the same version. So, okay. Well, I feel better. I didn't make the mistake then. Okay. So, we know that y to the p mod p equals y whenever y is in this appropriate range and p is a prime. Okay? Now, we need to show more, and you're going to do that on your homework. You're going to show this for the general case that for an arbitrary exponent of the form we need, any exponent that's a multiple of p minus 1 times q minus 1 plus 1 will also have this property. So it's a generalization. Here we've got the exponent p. Here we've got a generalization. And you're going to do that by induction also. It'll be an easier induction, but you're going to do an induction. Okay? Induction on K effectively. And I'm actually going to take you through. There are several problems on the homework. The homework isn't posted yet because 4 of the problems are done and the 5th depends on how far I get tonight. And I don't want to post it and then have to retract it. That'd be bad. So it's not posted yet, but it will be posted soon. It should be posted tomorrow. And you'll get to actually most of your homework, 3 of your problems, will effectively be showing that RSA really works. So you're going to get into the meat of it. Do it. Okay. And this is true when P and Q are 2 distinct primes. And K is less than or equal to 0. Greater than or equal to 0. Yes. Greater than or equal to 0. 0 is less than or equal to. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Good. Actually, it works for k less than 0 also, but you don't need to know that.
So your problem with the tool here is just to make sure that we pay attention and follow the notes, right?
Definitely. That's the best excuse I've heard yet. Absolutely. Okay. I want to take about 5 more minutes to talk about finding primes. Should I do that now, or are you dying for a break, and should we come back and talk about how to find primes when we come back?
Go ahead.
Go? Redmond, I can go?
Yep.
Go, okay. So, looking for prime. One thing to need if you're going to do this is prime numbers. And if you're going to use RSA and you want it to be hard for people to factor, you need big prime numbers. So the first thing that comes up is, are there big prime numbers? Are there enough big prime numbers? Can you find them? How? Okay? So I'm going to give you an ancient proof that there are plenty of prime numbers out there, or at least enough in the sense that there are an infinite number of prime numbers. And this is a trivial proof. Infinite number is actually not necessarily enough. I'll show you. You actually need to be able to say more. But I'll explain. It's not as crazy as it sounds.
Aleph 1 versus Aleph null type argument?
No, it's not that. It's that, yeah, it's density. If there's an infinite number of primes, but there's only one 512-digit prime out there, and there's only one 1024-bit prime out there, or whatever charge you're choosing, and the protocol says choose two primes of this size, you're going to be in trouble. If there are not, so an infinite number doesn't mean there are enough of each size, and there have to be lots of each size, so that yours will be different from mine, and I won't be able to guess yours. Okay. But let's just prove first that there are an infinite number of primes, because this is a trivial, simple, and very cute proof. Suppose that there are, this is not true. We're going through all the basic proof techniques here. We've done induction, this is going to be a proof by contradiction, and there'll be direct proofs. So let's suppose, by contradiction, that this isn't true. There are a finite number of primes out there. You can't assume what you're trying to prove, but you can assume the opposite and show that leads to an absurdity. So let's assume there are a finite set of primes. Well, then what I can do is multiply them all together. The finite set might be big. The product is going to be enormous, but it's going to be a number. There are finite, any finite set of numbers you can multiply together. It's going to be a number. Let's take a look at that number. Let's add one to that number. And scratch our heads and look at that number. Added one to it. Well, that we got by just adding one. That number might be a prime. But if it's a prime, it's not on the list. It's bigger than anything on the list because it's the product of everything on the list. So it's not a prime. But it's got to then factor. And can any of the factors be on the list? The factors, the prime factors of this number, well, all the primes are divisors of n. They're not going to be divisors of n and n plus 1. They're all going to be 1. N plus 1 is going to be 1 mod all these prime factors. So it must factor into other prime factors that are not on the list. But the list was all the primes. So I just contradicted the claim that that it's possible to form a list of all the primes. There is no finite list of all the primes. There's a contradiction. There must therefore be an infinite number of primes. Okay? Very short, simple proof. Now, as I said, it's not enough to know there are an infinite number. You have to know that there are enough, that there are lots of any size you want. So there is the prime number theorem, which I'm not going to prove. Yeah, John's laughing at me because we would spend half of the rest of the course proving the prime number theorem. But the prime number theorem is very useful, even though we're not going to prove it. It says basically the number of primes less than n is roughly n divided by the natural log of n. Pretty close to it. And another way of saying that is if you pick n bit integers, and now I've got little n here, little n bit integers, about one out of every n of those little n bit integers will be prime. Okay? They're well distributed, it's nice and random. And this isn't exactly because this logarithm is log base e, it's natural logarithm rather than log base 2. So it's actually more like about 0.7 out of every n randomly selected n bit integers is prime, but this gets you the right order. It's approximately that. Okay. So, now that we know there are plenty out there, we can just start picking them randomly, and we've got a good chance of hitting one. We have to see what we can do. Well, a natural thing to do, and something that many people do, is just, well, pick a big number. I've got a 1 in n chance, roughly. If n is going to be a 512-bit, if I'm looking for 512-bit primes, then I've got a 1 chance in 512. If I'm clever enough to think, and I won't pick an even one, I'll go for an odd, then it's 1 and 2 is 56. It's not so bad. But I need to know whether to pick, okay, is this prime? Well, it's not divisible by 3, it's not divisible by 5. Okay, I guess it's probably prime. Not quite good enough. So we have to talk a little bit about testing primality. Now, Fermat's little theorem gives us a pretty good test, although we want to do a little bit better. And his minor tweak on this gives us something that's provably better. Fermat's little theorem gives this property for all numbers that are prime. They have the property that any number that's smaller than this, any a in this range 0 to p, has this property. So what can I do with this? We talked about this a little bit last time. This is true of all primes. It's not necessarily false of all composites, all non-primes. So if I pick a number a and I do this test and it fails, then I know a is not prime. And you did that on your homework last week. Okay? That doesn't prove that number is prime. It can only prove that number is composite. However, if I do this test and I get the answer I expect, then the number is almost certain to be prime. But we can do better than almost certain, so we'd like to do better, because there are some numbers, they're called pseudo-primes, Carmichael numbers, there are a lot of variants on them, that actually, for many A's in this range, actually do satisfy this test, even though the number is not prime. And we want to, even though there are very few of these out there, they're very rare, we don't want to stumble on them and get something that's not prime.
Those kind of numbers have at least one A that would fail this test.
Yes.
So this is really an if and only if.
Well, it's an if and only if you do for all. And the reason is that if P is not prime, then if we take a factor of P, P is not prime, it has factors in this range. If we take a factor, there's no way we're going to get a factor of P and raise it to some power and take it mod P and get 1. Because whatever factor is going to stay there when we exponentiate, when we take it mod P, and you saw that a little bit in your homework. If P is a multiple of 3, and there are some Carmichael numbers that are multiples of 3, in fact. If P is a multiple of 3, and we take A equal 3 here, then any power of A is also going to be a multiple of 3, and when we take it mod this multiple of 3, we're going to get a multiple of 3. So, yeah, it is the case that it's only true for all A when P is prime. But you can't effectively test all A for large numbers. You can just try some. And Carmichael numbers have the property that a large fraction of them will satisfy this test, a large fraction of the A's. So we want to avoid that. And there turns out to be a good way to do it. So just a couple more minutes, then I promise we will break. The Miller-Rabin test is a variant which has provably very good properties. And I'll speak to the properties a little bit without actually writing them out. We want to test n for primality, and what we do is we take n minus 1, presumably n is odd. If it's not odd, it's pretty easy to figure out. Even, is it 2? 2 prime, not 2, not prime. Okay, settled. So now we care about the odd case. Look at an odd, n minus 1 is even, and what we can do is now take out every power of 2 in n minus 1. There might be only 1 2 there. It might be 2 times an odd number. It might be a multiple of 4. It might be a multiple of 8. It might be whatever. But we strip out the even component, and we're left with the odd component, n. Okay? Now, what we can do is repeat the following. Select the random value A, very much as you would do with Fermat's Law theorem, in the appropriate range. And you compute these powers, all mod n. Now, this looks like a lot of work.
Confused here. N is odd, so n minus 1 is even.
N minus 1 is even.
Which is, right.
Which is why here.
But why is m odd? If n is 9, then.
Well, okay. 9 is not a great case here. I'll explain in a minute. Let's take n to be 15. 15 minus 1 is 14. 14, I can take out the even component of, which is just 1, 2, and I'm left with 7. Mm-hmm. So 14 is 2 times 7. If I started with 13, subtract 1, I've got 12. 12 is now 2 times 2 times 3, and the m there would be 3.
Yeah, the reason I pick 9 is because it's a difficult one.
Well, it's difficult. Says,
you can't always get an odd
integer. You can. It's just the odd integer is 1 there.
1, okay. Boring. Okay.
Yeah, it's boring in that case. At that point, you know, it still works, actually.
Okay.
Works just fine. It's just it's a boundary case. Okay. So here, I'm asking you to do a lot of computations, a lot of these exponentiations. But actually, it's not that hard. All you really do is compute a to the m here, mod m, and then square it to get that, and square it to get that. And keep on squaring as many times as necessary.
You square it mod, right?
Square it and then take it mod.
Yeah.
So
that was one thing that on the homework wasn't totally clear. So I was saying, what do we gain by doing repeated squaring? Because it just becomes
a huge. It wasn't odd that you could square the mod. It wasn't obvious you could square the mod from the way you wrote it up.
Anyway,
that was what's confusing.
I'm sorry if it wasn't clear. The mod ends can take up a lot of space, and. Algebraically, one often just dispenses with it entirely, says, we're working in the field of the integers modulo p, and done, you never see the mod again.
Yeah.
I tried to bring it in, but maybe I should
remember
more.
We're pretty clueless.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to agree.
it's okay.
But, yes, it's important to reduce things mod n as quickly as you can. Or mod p, or whatever the modulus is, because it gets really expensive to carry along bigger and bigger numbers. You want to expand and then reduce. So each of these things, you do this computation, a to the m mod n, and that computation is done by a repeated squaring method, where every time you square and every time you do a possible side multiply, you reduce mod n, and then each of these square and reduce mod n, square and reduce mod n, each time from then on. Okay? So, we do this calculation, and there's a very easy thing you can check for. If a to the m is plus or minus 1, or if some value along the way is minus 1, then that's exactly the behavior you would expect to get. If n is prime. What else could happen? Well, a to the m might not be 1. That's the usual case. Or maybe you'll get something that squares up to 1 eventually, which would make it look like it passes Fermat's little theorem. But mod composites, there are other square roots of 1. Maybe you'll do something like 3 squared and you'll get 1. 3 squared mod 8 is 1, even though 3 is not plus 1, 3 is not minus 1. 3 squared is 1. So 1 has more than 2 square roots. And if you hit one of those other square roots, then you say, primes don't do that. So basically, simple test, simple variant of the same cost as Fermat's little theorem, but you can actually prove something about this. You can prove that for any composite at all, at most 1/4 of the possible A's that you might choose will pass this test. So that means that all you have to do is try this for as many random A's as you care to. If you try it for 10 random A's and there's a 1 in a million chance that it will pass, at most, one in a million chance. And in practice, it's way, way less than that. Way, way, way less than that. Try the Miller-Rabin test for 10 values. If it passes, it's prime. Okay? So this is a very effective test.
How big does I get?
How big does I? Which is I?
In A to the 2 to the I, M equals negative 1.
A to the... Oh, here. I gets as big as K up here. You just square up to 2 to the K. Sorry. This is the upper limit, a to the n minus 1 over 2. Actually, you can stop one short. You can do k minus 1. You don't have to go all the way to n minus 1. So it's actually one square and short of the full Fermat test. And it's just saying, be a little bit more intelligent as you go, look at what you're getting along the way, and you'll probably be able to stop sooner, and you get higher confidence. You get much greater certainty. And I'm not going to go into the why. There's some elaborate things here, but this gives it to you. Okay. So.
Are we doing this on the homework too? Just determining the primality of a number?
I'm not planning on assigning anything, testing the primality. You already showed it to somebody come up. Well, that might be a decent possibility if we don't get to it. Let's see. See, that'll teach you to ask questions. Okay, so if you actually ever get an exception, if you ever get anything other than this or this, then you know immediately it's composite. You've disproven the theory of a prime, and you can stop. Okay, so what do we do in practice? Do we just pick random numbers and apply the Miller-Rabin test? Usually not. The test is somewhat expensive, and having to repeat this a few hundred times to find out, oh, that's a multiple of 3. Oh, that's a multiple of 5. Oh, that's a multiple of 11. Is a waste of time. So what we do in practice is sit it. And what I'll be doing in practice here is burning trees because of people printed out. And sorry, I had one slide that had all of this on it, and now it became 20 slides. And deconstructed it. But let me show you how sitting works, and it's very quick. Start with a random value n. Whatever your starting point is. And the first thing you do is you figure out, okay, well, maybe n is odd. So n plus 1 is even. Once I figure out where the first even number is, I can just go through and get rid of all the other multiples of 2 on my little table. Okay? If you're clever, you can actually get rid of the whole table for the n equal 2 and just test for odd values because you never have to look at even values at all. So, in fact, this is one speed up that we did about 10 years ago. That was a dramatic speed up of getting rid of sieving out all the evens. You don't have to do a lot of work on evens. You know they're not prime. Okay, let's go up to the multiples of 3. Let's suppose that over here n plus 2 turned out to be a multiple of 3. Well, that means other multiples of 3 must be 3 apart from that. So n plus 5 is a multiple of 3. Yes, it's already ticked, but I ticked it again in my little array. N plus 8, n plus 11, I tick again for the second time. It's okay. It's worth just going through and ticking it. Don't test if it's 0 and then set it to 1. If it is 0 and it needs to be set to 1, just set it to 1. It might already be 1. You don't care. You want to just know the places that are already bad and already are known not to be prime. Okay?
So I see you realize this cost is really big and you take a whole bunch.
About 1,000. But not that huge normally.
Not necessarily starting at 0.
Oh no, I picked a random starting point.
It's a real high number.
Large number. Yeah. Some, if I'm looking for 512 bit prime, I pick a random 512 bit number to start with. Okay? And I'm constructing it like this. Let's do multiples of 5. Let's assume that we find out that n is actually a multiple of 5. Our starting point is a multiple of 5. Okay. Well, we don't have to start over because I'm not just looking at n. I'm looking at everything else, too. So n is a multiple of 5. N plus 5 is a multiple of 5. That's getting ticked a lot. That box, that's a multiple of 2, 3, and 5.
So using something you said earlier, if I'm looking for a 512-bit prime, I grab a random 512-bit number, and I make an array that probably ought to be on the order of 512
exactly
down the long.
Actually, what I give a factor of two, and you'll be dead on for what I've done in the past, let's say. I actually do make an array of size 512 for a 512-bit prime, except my array only looks at the odd values, so I'm effectively going 1024 bits out. Or 1024 values out.
There is a prime in that range, then.
Well, there is probably a prime in that range. I don't want to go indefinitely. I don't want to put too long.
So why not pick some smaller number of bits, like 509 bits, and then multiply by 2 times 5 times 7 times 9, pick that number, and then just step without having to test.
You can do that. That can eliminate the 2, 3, 5, and 7, the very small primes. Mm-hmm. It's actually a nice way of doing things. It does force you to make a determination in advance of what the characteristics of the number are going to be, mod 3, mod 5. You have to decide, okay, if it's going to be 1, if I'm going to multiply by 2, 3, 5, and 7, and then add 1, then the resulting number is going to be 1 more than a multiple of 3. So it's 1 mod 3.
Well, not necessarily. You could take... I'm going to make a field of 100 of them, and I'll take a random one from those.
Yeah, you could, but it forces you to make a choice in advance, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But yeah, that is actually a viable approach of getting rid of the small values by constructing something so that you already know that. And that's effectively what you do when you get rid of all the evens. It's just taking it a step further.
Right.
And it's definitely workable, and it's an approach people use, absolutely. Okay, so let me finish. Here's n plus 10 is the last. And all I have done after this is gone through, and yes, this array only has 12 values in it, but you might have hundreds of values or even a couple thousand values in this array. And at this point, with a relatively small amount of work, I've eliminated most candidate primes, and there are only a few good candidates left. There's this one here and this one here that at least they're not multiples of 2, 3, or 5. Maybe these I'll try. In practice, what we typically do is go through all the small primes less than about 1,000, and it's faster to just zip through those and then get to the point where, okay, these are the candidates to run Miller-Rabin on. And we'll just run Miller-Rabin, and the first time we hit a prime, we stop. This does introduce a little bit of skewing, but not enough to worry about. If you think about this...
What is skewing? What does that mean?
Well, okay, so it was pointed out years ago that you're supposed to choose a random prime, right? Well, suppose n plus 6 and n plus 4 are both primes, and suppose there are no primes for like 500 numbers below n plus 4. Okay? Now, if I build this array and sieve, and I start working up and looking for primes, the chance of my stopping here is much bigger than the chance of my stopping here. Because the only way I'm going to stop here is if I started right here or here. If I had any of the 500 previous starting points, then I'm going to stop and hit that one. So this means that this prime down here is about, well, a few hundred, let's say. If this is 500, this is 250 times more likely to be selected than this prime. Now, in practice, we made the decision of skewing of a factor of 100 or a couple hundred doesn't matter that much. But this is what typically happens when we use RSA. We don't pick primes uniformly. We usually pick primes with this rather skewed distribution. And the only thing I insist on is that we limit the skew. What some people have done is said, well, this whole array has failed, so now I'll just go to the end of the array, n plus 1024 or whatever it is, and start fresh at the end and keep on going from there. And that leaves you absolutely no limit. Now, if there's a gap of 100,000 somewhere, then the prime at the very top of that gap is going to be way, way more likely to be chosen than many other primes. So if you just limit the size of this to 1,000, say, then your skew is limited by a factor of 1,000 at most. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a question back there.
I was just going to say, would it reduce the skew by randomly picking into the list of possible candidates?
People usually don't bother, but one thing you could do is build this table, and then you randomly reorder the candidates that survive, and you go through that. And that's a good possibility. But you still don't want to then go to the next group and the next group after that, next thousand consecutively, because you will wind up with the same problem. But yeah, that does reduce the skewing. People usually don't bother, but it's a reasonable thing to do.
Are these primes we're picking are public key at all, or related to the public key?
These primes, if you use RSA, are going to be, what you're going to do is pick two of these primes, multiply them together, and that's going to be your RSA modulus.
Okay. So basically, you would totally know if someone happened to get the same prime as someone else because they'd have the same key.
Well, if they got both primes the same, they would.
Yeah.
If they had one prime the same, then you might not notice it. In fact, I know somebody who's proposed, you know, looking to see if people's random number generators might be somewhat skewed badly by taking all the RSA keys he could find and computing the greatest common denominators in pairs, effectively, by multiplying together and computing GCDs, and seeing if a prime pops out. If as soon as a prime pops out, you know, this is a prime that was used by that person and that person, and now I factored both of their moduli, and I know both of their keys.
Huh. Wow.
But as far as I know, he hasn't actually bothered to do this. He might sometime. He's the sort of person who would. Okay, well, I've pushed things for quite a while. We'll take a break. I'll come back. We'll do why don't we take a 10-minute break now, and we'll have another break. Resume at 8:14.
I should be clear about this. X to the Y mod N equals X to the Y. Now if I do that, then X to the E might be an encryption. And if I raise that to the E power, then this is going to come out, and this is all mod N equals to the X to the E times B is equal to X to the Y, which is X factor. So X to the E is the way to enter X, and then raising that to the power of D, that is an equal to the different factor. Because of the property that E times D has, you know, this special form. Okay.
I was looking at N and its two factors, and those factors.
It's right there. It's this multiplication. Okay. But in order for this to be the case,
you need
Y to have. Why have to be the four? Why not? I'm happy to do that. People have complained in the past. But let's see, is there no complaint?
It depends on the nature of the material you're presenting. On the way you've got this laid out, to walk through the windows. I'm understanding a lot better. You're thinking about it.
So, you know what?
Yeah, that's the plan. So you said we could address this a little bit later.
Yeah,
I don't know if we have time right now, but
probably now is
good. We were just, I was just commenting to say, I'm sure about how the and I think I understand the concept of this although see, you did make me point out that showing the module you brought inside the fence is a different assumption.
Somebody else said that. I'm not quite sure. You have the
one bounce. So I would
like to I saw somebody else who got
So I would be fine if they just be seven like these other guys who didn't show why you're hearing it.
So what I would say is that an integer of the form, or Q and R are integers, mod m, that term.
Were you the one who said that?
So here I've got an integer.
That was my main error there, is I didn't show this. Now, of course, I shouldn't have put this here because I broke the rules of the street, mathematics or whatever. But as far as what I didn't do, other people got seven for that.
I'm not in a position to really look at it now.
Okay.
At the end of the night.
And I'll be around.
I'm going to play it.
I'm only just.
I get
they can be responded to as they have alleged
I think you should tell him about IB though. So they coordinate both ends and realize there's someone here.
In Australia, they actually.
That's an example of where they have data.
They just started.
But there's nothing
technical
in the UK.
They
as soon as they're checking it everywhere,
broadcasting everywhere.
If you're an American citizen and a resident of the world, you know, I suppose it's supposed to put in the government. So long as I'm not supposed to be paying taxes, they don't
care.
It's
very civilized, though,
if you ask me. If they want taxes out of me, then they'll care.
Yeah. The U.S. cares because they want to make sure that.
I
used to live in Toronto. It's an interesting situation because the Canadian tax rate is higher, which is fine. Good.
Sure.
Better services, no problem. But I was actually in a situation of I had U.S. taxes and Canadian taxes, and my Canadian taxes became deductible against my U.S. taxes. So I had the option of, here are some deductions I'm eligible for on the Canadian taxes. If I take them, the money just goes to the U.S. government. If I don't take them, it goes to the Canadian government.
That was why you were in Canada, right?
If you don't take the deductions, does that qualify as a tax fraud on the U.S. part?
I don't see that. I don't think I'm required to take the deductions.
Hey, the statute of limitations on that, as his attorney, has long since run out. So.
that's true. I was I left Toronto in 1990, so yeah, I think that's long gone. Okay. Well, also notice, we seem to be on slide 68 out of 169. So we'll see what happens. There's some flexibility here, but let's see what happens. There's actually just one more thing I want to talk about RSA, and it's another thing that there's going to be a homework problem on. The proving that RSA works is going to be most of the assignment. Three problems, the way I've got it set up right now. There's going to be one more problem on this thing, and that's the other part of what we left. We've done this now. We've shown that this relationship here is true. Okay? Now, to finish RSA, what we need to do is tap the slide and make it come out. There we go. We need to show that It's possible for Alice or whoever is setting up an RSA key to pick integers E and D that when multiplied together and taken mod P minus 1, Q minus 1, satisfy this so that they can be used up here. And what this means, as you recall, I hope you recall, I didn't put the slide back, is that means that any y now raised to the eth power, I guess I can write it over here, y to the eth power, I won't bother to write the mod n, because there won't be enough room, is an encryption of y, and then when I raise it to the dth power, that's effectively a decryption, because that's equal to y to the e times d, which satisfies this property by what I've asserted down here. And since it satisfies that property, then y to the e times d is just equal to y again. So y to the e is the encryption of y, raising it to the d power gets y back, effectively decrypts. That's how RSA works. An RSA signatures work the other way. You raise to the dth power to sign, you raise to the eth power to verify a signature. You get y back when you verify, that means yes is a valid signature. Okay, so, back to this part. How do I compute E and D that have this property? It turns out to be relatively easy. In fact, it turns out that I can pretty much pick any E that I want and compute D from it that has this property. Okay? And remember we mentioned last time that RSA, most people use the exponent 65537 all the time, 2 to the 16th plus 1. Well, that's almost always the value chosen for E, so given that that's the public E, I've got to find a way of computing D that matches that and satisfies this.
And narrow down the space of choices for D?
It narrows it down. It's often, well, it could be just one. I will give you a method that computes one D from that. Now, there actually are often equivalent Ds that also serve as decryption exponents, but you only need one.
What minus one?
Sorry?
E is often 2 to the what minus
1? Oh, E, I'm pretty sure I have this right for you. E is often 2 to the 16th plus 1.
Plus one.
Plus one. Yeah, equals 65537. This is a very commonly used, almost universally used RSA encryption exponent. There's no reason not to use a small constant. There's no reason not for it not to be small. And this is a nice property. It's a prime, and if you write it in binary, it's got a 1 at the beginning and a 1 at the end, and 0 is all in between, so it means when you're doing square and then side multiply, square and then side multiply, the side multiplies only happen when there's a 1 in that bit of the exponent. Well, this has very few 1s, so it's almost all squaring, and that's faster to compute. Okay, so I've messed up this slide pretty well now, so let's move on. Okay, so modular arithmetic. How do we do this? Well, computing A plus B mod N is easy, right? You've done that, we've talked about that, you've had it on your homework, you can take A plus B and take the result mod N, or you can take the intermediate result mod N, no problem. Subtraction, easy. Multiplication, you multiply, take it mod N. Division? What's 6 divided by 5 mod 11? Well, you actually did on your homework last time by hand some computations of that sort, mod 11. You found that actually, if I recall, 2 times 5, so 9 is the inverse of 5, mod 11. 9 times 5 is 1. So 6 divided by 5 would be the same as 6 times 1 over 5, and 1 over 5 is 9, so it's 6 times 9, which is 54, mod 11, which is 10. Bizarre. 6 divided by 5 is 10. But it is, mod 11. But how would you actually compute that? How do you figure out what 1 divided by something, what a reciprocal is? Okay? Well, that's what we're going to do right now. So, Here are some examples. 1 divided by 2 mod 7 means we need a solution to 2 times something mod 7 equals 1. Right? That's just the definition of division. 2 times what mod 7 equals 1? Okay? Somebody can probably figure this out online.
4.
Good. 4 works here. Okay? Let's do another one. 7 divided by 5 mod 11. I just did 6 divided by 5, so 7 divided by 5 shouldn't be too hard, right? The solution to 5x mod 11 equals 7. Well, what does it turn out to be? I just figured out that the reciprocal of 5 mod 11 seemed to be 9, so 9 times 7 should be 63, which is 3 less than 66, which is 0 mod 11, so 3 less than 0 is, so it should be 8. Did I get that?
8.
Good. It works. Try it, verify it. 8 times 7, 56. It's 1 more than 55. It really is 1 mod 11. Okay. I didn't look ahead, even though I can see. There are slides. I can see the slides, but I didn't cheat, I promise. Never trust a cryptographer. Okay. So how do you do this modular division? Is it always well-defined even? What's 1/3 mod 6? 1 divided by 3. That means I have to compute 3 times something mod 6 equals 1. That's the equation I would have to solve. And that has no solution. Why? Well, we mentioned this a little bit earlier. If I take any x, the result of 3 times x is going to be a multiple of 3. When I divide by 6, the remainder is still going to be a multiple of 3. Right? Division is like repeated subtraction. So I'm subtracting 6 a large number of times, or some number of times. A multiple of 3, and I subtract some number of 6s, those are all multiples of 3. I still got a multiple of 3. There's no way I'm going to get 1. So this has no solution.
So I'm going to ask a dumb question. 7 divided by 5 mod 11, you can't do 7 divided by 5 is 6. 1 or something. And then mod 11.
You're sort of rounding. You're taking the integer.
No.
These are exact calculations. They'll work both ways. So if 7 divided by 5 were 1, then 1 times 5 should be 7. And you lost precision when you did when you dropped the fractional part. When you're doing it with mods, you should have, this should all be exact. There should be no fractional parts. Mods, after all, sort of are the fractional remainders already. We don't want to get into second order remainders and it get to be a mess. No, we want exact solutions here. And it's important in any crypto thing. You know, small little error magnifies and you'll decrypt something and it'll just be off by a little bit in every character. That's not going to be good. Okay. So here's a fact. A divided by B mod N always has a solution when B and N have no common factors other than 1. Their GCD is 1. This is the function that John talked about a little bit over the homework. The greatest common divisor of B and N is 1. There's no common factor larger than 1. Between
these things. Is it also called denominator principle?
Usually not. There's no denominator with these values. These values are integers. There's no denominator here.
Okay.
2 integers, and if we want the greatest common divisor among these integers. It's sometimes confused because when you often use the LCM, the least common multiple, which is related to the GCD, to form a common divisor when you're adding fractions. A common denominator, sorry, when you're adding fractions. But no, it's the greatest common divisor. That's what it stands for. Or as John said in Britain,
highest common factor.
Yep, no. Okay. Okay, now, does this go both ways? I'll just mention, this thing always has a solution when GCD of B and N is 1. It's almost true the other way, but we have to add a little bit. There's no solution if A and B are effectively in lowest terms. Now it's starting to sound like fractions again. If A and B have no common divisor other than one, and that.
Yeah, the question mark that's
equals.
Well, on my slide here, I've got a question mark.
We have an
oh, yeah, that's right. Here's a question. Do you have an
not equals? We have an not equals.
Yeah, that's the same book. There's some stuck characters, but those seem to print out right.
But they printed this time. They didn't
that's
print last time.
That's the PowerPoint, and that's that other tool.
Yeah, I guess
so.
Ed
Stiller might have that book.
I guess, yeah.
Some people still have problems with the PowerPoint printing, though, last night, but this time not.
Okay, so the PowerPoint is correct. We'll try to figure this out. Richard... Okay.
So which of these is not a Microsoft?
But the PDF is right also. Right?
The presenter is not a Microsoft.
Jim from
the classroom presenter.
Yeah, the last set of slides, the PowerPoint, the PDF itself looked right on my screen, and then when I printed it, all the meaningful figures went to the empty boxes.
Ooh,
yeah. Special.
Yeah, I had it between two computers on stage.
Okay, it's probably a matter of what fonts are installed. I'm using all default PowerPoint standard fonts and symbols and everything. The PowerPoint is fine. You have builds fine in PowerPoint. It's the presenter that's...
The weird thing is PDF is supposed to be a portable document format. It's supposed to embed the fonts. Yeah. And stuff. Don't know what happened, but anyway.
I've many times tried to open a PowerPoint document, a PDF file that says, sorry, we don't have the fonts. Would you like to use these instead? Okay. Anyway, let's go on to something more crypto-related. So let's talk about greatest common divisors a little bit more. This is something that looks a little surprising if you haven't seen it before, but if you think about it, there's a trivial proof that the GCD of A and B is the GCD of B and A minus B, or A and A minus B, for that matter. Why is that the case? Well, if I have any factor of A that's also a factor of B, then it's also going to be a factor of A plus B and A minus B. Right? This is if A is a multiple of 7 and B is a multiple of 7, then if I add them, I've got a bigger multiple of 7. But they're still. If I subtract them, I've got probably a smaller multiple of 7, but it's still a multiple of 7. 7 just distributes in, gets everything.
Mm-hmm. That is true, but how can you make sure that model 7 could be that model 5?
How can I make sure that?
A minus B is more than 5 or something.
Okay.
Or less than 7.
It can be negative, it's okay. So. Was that your question? That could be negative, or well, let me finish and let me finish this proof.
Let's see here, for example, A, B. Mm-hmm. You could have like a 7 and 5, both of their divisors.
Okay, so
when you A minus B,
let me finish.
5, right?
Let me finish, and then question me if it's not clear. Any factor of A and B is also a factor of A minus B.
Yeah,
similarly, the other way, any factor of A minus B and B is also a factor of A, right? Because A minus B, whatever this thing is, if I add B to it, I get A. So this is just the same as A and B gets A plus B. So anything that's a factor of these two is also a factor of this. Okay? So it's not just the case that some factors. Any factor of A and B is also a factor. Any common factor of A and B is also a common factor of B and A minus B. Any single factor of this is also a factor of this, and any common factor of these two is also a common factor of these two. Okay? That means that since all the common factors are the same, the greatest common factor of those two is also the greatest common factor of those two. Okay, good. I thought I'd get it, I just wanted to make sure. Okay. So, tricky little proof, but it's a very short, quick little proof. Okay. So, what does that mean? Oh. Since any common factor of A and B is also a factor of A minus B, there's the proof. Okay. So, this means here's a way we can compute greatest common divisor fairly quickly. I can't factor things quickly. You might think, well, how do I compute the greatest common divisor of two things? Well, I factor this, I see what the divisors are, what's the greatest. That can be hard with big numbers. but you can compute the greatest common divisor, the greatest common factor, very efficiently, even on huge numbers that you can't factor. Here, GCD of 21 and 12. I'm just going through this. Notice I've moved AB to B. I've moved B to the left and then A minus B. So 21, 12 becomes 12, 9. 21 minus 12 is 9. Becomes 9 and then 3. Becomes 6 and 3 when I subtract off. Actually, yeah, well, it works both ways, but then I guess that should have been the 3 moved over here. Oh, I did this backwards is what I did. This should have been 3 and 6, and then 6 and 3. So just say, obviously the greatest common divisor of A and B is the same as the greatest common divisor of B and A. So I should have done this one first, and then I just swap them for convenience and subtract this. Subtract this, and eventually you get that. Because the GCD of anything and zero is the anything. Because zero has a lot of factors. Anything is a divisor of zero. Anything, you know. 73 million times zero is zero. So 73 million is a factor of zero. So the greatest common factor of zero and anything else is going to be that other thing. Because the greatest factor of three is three. Okay. So let's look and see if we can do even a little bit better. So we can do this repeated subtraction to compute GCDs. Well, this means we can save ourselves a little bit of time and say we can subtract B repeatedly in one step if we feel like it. Okay? Well, A minus something times B, that's kind of the remainder of division. A divided by B, the remainder is A minus some multiple of B, right? Division is really just repeated subtraction. So one particular case, for the case of K being equal to the quotient, the rounded, and here I'll talk about rounding a little bit, round down A divided by B, take the integer part of that, use that as K, and you'll get A minus B. This is just one particular case. If I subtract B from A often enough, I'll get A mod B. Maybe at zero times, K might be zero, but some number of times I'll get A minus, I'll get A mod B. Okay? So this is one particular case for which this works. Now, let's apply that. We do the same thing, things go a lot more quickly. Because I can now, for 21, GCD 21, 12, I take 12 and 21 mod 12, which is 9. But then the next step, I guess the next step is the same as the last one too, 9 and 12 mod 9, which is 3, but then 9 mod 3 is 0 immediately, and I save myself some work. And if I've got really big numbers, I might save a lot of work by just doing mods using division as a shortcut to a lot of subtractions. Okay? Now, what I want to talk about is the extended Euclidean algorithm. The Euclidean algorithm, due to Euclid, is sometimes referred to as the world's oldest algorithm. I don't know if that's really true. Some people have made that assertion. You? I'm not sure. But it's plausible anyway. And that's what we just did, effectively, is a version of the Euclidean algorithm. But you can take this a little bit further. And what I want to do is find, given A and B, find other integers, which are also often called cofactors, such that this is true. So given 21 and 12, find something I can multiply 21 by and something I can multiply 12 by, such that the two products, when added together, get the GCD, which is 3. Okay? And I'm going to care about this most when I get a GCD of 1. Two things that have a GCD of 1 are called relatively prime. They have no common factors other than 1, no common prime factors, so we call them relatively prime. Okay. So when the GCD is 1, look at what this does for us. I can solve this equation, which is the equation that I really wanted to solve before, by finding x and y such that ax plus by equals 1. Why is that true? Well, now that we know that we can move mods inside of things, if we take this mod b, this goes away, and I get ax mod b equals 1. Okay? So if I can find x and y that satisfy this equation, then I can compute an inverse, a reciprocal of a. I found an x that when multiplied by a equals 1. Okay? And if I wanted to do more general, divide c by a, then what I would do is divide 1 by a, get the reciprocal, and multiply by c. That's the usual way of doing things. Okay. So, let's take a look at the Euclidean algorithm again. I'll do it with the mod version, and we'll blow it up a little bit. So here, I want to compute the greatest common divisor of 35 and 8. And I'm just going through the steps. Okay, well, now it's 8 and 35 mod 8, which is 8 and 3. The GCD of 8 and 3 is now the GCD of 3 and 8 mod 3, which is 3 and 2, 2 and 1, 1 and 0, and I get 1. So that's the usual case, the case that I like, that the two values I started with, 35 and 8, are relatively prime. Okay, yes?
Slightly off topic, why would this be the oldest algorithm in the world? Non-Knuth says so.
Yeah. I don't know. This actually dates back to the Greek period.
I wonder what would have led to the development of that. Like, why would cavemen have needed this?
Well, probably not cavemen. But the ancient Greeks, around the time of Plato and such, really like looking at properties of numbers. And this is something that, here's a process that you have to go through to find some numbers that satisfy some simple properties.
Argument that addition and multiplication are algorithms.
Yeah, if you call them algorithms, they're certainly older. So yeah, part of it is, what do you call an algorithm? And yeah, how complicated does it have to be before you call it an algorithm versus some simple calculation? Okay, so now I'm going to take this and I'm going to rewrite it. The same thing in a way that will allow the computation of the cofactors. Okay? So 35 and 8 was where we started. And I'm writing it by as the quotient and the remainder. When if I divide 35 by 8, the integer part of the quotient is 4 and the remainder is 3. And this 3 is 35 mod 8, the remainder. Okay? Now, if we go beyond that, the next thing we did was we took the 8 and the 3, and we did the same thing. We computed 8 mod 3, and we got 2, and here was the quotient that if we actually did the division that allowed us to compute the remainder, we got that. So I'm going through exactly the same steps, I'm just showing them a little bit differently. 3 and 2 now come in here. 3 is 2 times 1 plus 1. 2 is 1 times 2, and there's nothing left over. And that's what I'm trying to get at, to the point where there's nothing left over, and that says the GCD is now over here. Okay. So, let's take a look at these things. I'm going to take now the green values over here and rewrite the equations as the remainders as the thing that I'm isolating. So this is just rewriting 3 equals 35 minus 8 times 4. 2 equals 8 minus 3 times 2. Right? Etc. Okay? Should be straightforward. High school algebra. Okay? Now, I don't want these things anymore because I need the space, so I'm going to take these things and I'll move them over. This is the closest you're going to get to animation with this. Here. I move them over. Okay. So here are these three equations. Now let's take a look at what I can do with these equations. In particular, starting down here. So what I'm going to do is now take 1 equals this, and I can substitute for 3 and 2 from here and here. Okay? Three was that I put here. Two was this that put here. And this end. Now, I'll do another round of substitutions because I still got this three here and I don't want that three there anymore. But three, I can do that. So I substituted for this three, this same thing that I've already substituted for three once before. I've got this. Don't worry, I'm not going to make you do something like this. And now, what happens when I collect the terms? I've got one represented as a bunch of multiples of 35 and 8. So if I collect the terms, there are three 35s and 8 13s, or 13 8s is the way to think of this. Okay, so what does this say is the reciprocal of 8 mod 35? We want to know at 8 times x mod 35 equals 1. Well, look at this. Here's 1 equals something times 35 minus 8 times 13. So if I take this mod 35, this goes away. We know we can do that. We can move inside of a sum or a simple arithmetic operation. We move the mod in. And now we've got 1 equals minus 8 times 13. Minus 8. Well, let me write it this way. Equals, and this is all mod 35. 8 times minus 13. Okay, is that all showing up? Okay, well, minus 13, that's also ugly. Well, mod 35 means when you get to 35, you go back to 0, right? 32, 33, 34, 0, 1, 2, 3. Okay? You can go back the other way. 3, 2, 1, 0, 34. So what's minus 13? Minus 13 is 13 below 0, which is the same as 13 below 35. 35 is the 0 point. So this is, another way of saying it is 8 times 22, if I want to normalize things. Because 22 and minus 13 are the same thing. It's 13 before 35, 22 after 35, they're 35 apart. Okay? Well, let's just do the check. 8 times 22 equals 176. 176 mod 35. Well, 5 times 35 is 175. So this indeed equals 1. So x equal 22 works. Okay? So I just found a way of computing an inverse. There. I had to deal with the negative case, which sometimes happens. Sometimes I'll do this and I'll get a negative number of 35s, which is good. That means I've got a positive number of the things I care about. But if I get a negative number, I can flip it around. But either way, I get the result. Okay? Does this make sense? Yep.
But wasn't motivated by all this algebra.
I don't think so, actually. I think that the modular arithmetic was mostly later. I think this is an extended version of the basic Euclidean algorithm, which is basically just division. Okay. Now, there's a lot of work here in back substitution through all of these things and all the terms that have to be collected. If, as you're doing the GCD calculation, you extend it, you do a little bit more, rather than the original Euclidean GCD algorithm. And that was the motivation for Euclid, by the way, greatest common divisors, with what real computation was of the Euclidean algorithm. Then you can keep track of a few more things and get these things done. Now, I'm going to give you a slide that has this concisely, but it's a little too concise, probably. It looks like code. It's a way that you can make a table. And if you just follow this through, basically what's going on here, I guess I have to explain the div step a little bit. This is integer division. So, 6 div 4 would be 1, division with no remainder. 23 div 4 would be 5. That's just the integer part of this divided by that. Okay? But this is now a complete algorithm that computes GCDs and while it's at it, maintains cofactors. The X and the Y are cofactors. And I'm not planning on going through this, so we can talk about it a little bit, but it really is straightforward. Be a computer for 5 minutes, follow the instructions. You've got an invariant that comes up here. These things are chosen so that for each step, you're just going through a loop, incrementing I, and for each value of I, this invariant says the starting values A and B have the property that XI and YI are cofactors that produce this value AI, and this AI value is the GCD value, or the part of the GCD that keeps going down toward 1. So the final AI, when this loop stops, is the GCD, and therefore the last I, you'll get cofactors XI and YI that'll give you, if the GCD is 1, 1 as you want. Okay, do we need to go through an example of this, or?
John.
Yes.
On the first line under repeat while, halfway across it, BI equals da da da. Should that be Q sub I and not just Q?
Q sub I here. There. Yes, it should be. Thank you. So, Q is a local variable. You don't actually need it for anything else. I could actually remove Q and in all these steps just substitute this quantity everywhere, but you're using this quantity 3 times. You're using it for BI, you're using it for XI, you're using it for YI. So I've created for convenience this calculate it once and use it in 3 places. And it could be just like temp. It doesn't really need to be subscripted, but I should be consistent. I shouldn't have subscripted it in some places and not in others.
So the question about whether or not we need to go through this probably depends on how often we'll be called upon to use it.
You will be called on to do this once. You will have one problem on this homework where you have to compute an inverse. And you compute an inverse by going through this. But it should be possible to do this, and it's very easy to check when you get to the end. And in fact, the very last step, if you push X and Y to the very end, what you'll get is XI is going to equal plus or minus B, and YI is going to equal plus or minus A. So you're going to actually get B and A to pop out at the bottom in reverse side if you do this, because the last step after, you keep on doing the GCDs until you get 0. Sort of 1 is the GCD, and then you get the last value is going to be 0. So if you push this 1 beyond the final I, you're going to get AI equals 0. And since you still got this relationship, then A times B minus B times A is going to also equal 0, and that gives you a check that, yes, I've done this. But also you can check by just multiplying and seeing, is this really an inverse like we did before? Okay? So what do you think? 2 or 3 minutes as an automaton, or is this boring and we'll go on?
Go on.
Okay. It's not hard to do. Okay, now we can actually start doing stuff. So, here's the slide that I mentioned didn't appear before. Digital signatures. Remember that with RSA, if you encrypt and then decrypt, it's like raising to the eth power and then the dth power, and this gives you Y. Back to where you started. That's the magic of RSA, that's how it works. Signing, you do the other direction. You decrypt, and then the verifier encrypts. Multiplication commutes, E times D equals D times E, you get the same thing. So Alice, knowing only the factorization of N, is the only one who knows the decryption exponent, the only one who can compute a Dth root, which is something which, when raised to the Eth power, comes back to the original. The Dth power is like an Eth root. They are inverses of each other. Okay. So, I'll get into a little bit now of sort of the political context of this. RSA invented the idea of digital signatures. It was great, a great breakthrough. A lot of people wanted to use it. A lot of people do use it. We use it on the internet constantly. The problem that some people had was this was invented by RSA. RSNA, Regression Neural Enablement, did this at MIT. Diffie and Hellman did their original invention at Stanford. Both patented their work. Both universities patented their work and then licensed it appropriately to the inventors. Well, appropriately is a relative term here, but licensed it to their inventors for relicensing out. This meant that during the early years of RSA, if you wanted to use it, technically you needed to get a license from the RSA company, which formed from RSNA, and they also had to get licensing from Stanford for the original patent on the idea of public key cryptography. But in particular, the original public key cryptography patent ran out sooner because that was earlier. There was still RSA, and people wanted to be able to do things without RSA. And in particular, the U.S. government wanted to create a digital signature algorithm that was royalty-free. It didn't require people to go out and purchase patent rights. So I'm not going to go through it in detail, but there is this digital signature algorithm that is used. The National Institute of Standards and Technology created this algorithm free of IP, and it's got some advantages, got some disadvantages. We'll talk about them in a minute, but I'll show you the algorithm without going through in gory detail. I'm showing it to you. There it is. So there are a bunch of parameters. P is a prime. Usually, now we would want it to be 1024 bits. 512 bits is too weak for today's uses, but it's standardized as to range from 512 to 1024 bits.
RSA still licensed? You still need to license?
The patent has expired.
Oh.
It was a big party. There's another prime Q, which is much shorter, always fixed at 160 bits, such that Q divides P minus 1. Okay. So P is chosen to be 1 greater than a multiple of Q. So the way you would do this is not pick P, subtract 1, and try to factor it. Instead, you pick Q, you take a big multiplier, big multiplier of Q, a big multiple of Q. So Q times something big to get you as many bits as you want, 1024 bits. Add 1 and say, is this prime? Uh-huh, good. Oh, it's not? Darn, let me try again. Mostly a lot of darn, let me try again, because you can't really sieve quite as well, although there are ways of sieving here. You choose an integer, H, in this range. You choose another integer, G, which is computed like this. You choose a secret value, X, and you get a public value, Y, computed from this. By the way, P, Q, H are all public. H is public? Yeah, H is public, G is public. The only private thing that you have is your X, and Y is your public signature key. Okay? The way you use the algorithm is you sign a message as follows, and it's going to look weird, and I'm not going to try to justify the computation here. You can do it on your own. Generate a random integer. I want to sign n. I generate a random K in this range. And I make this utterly bizarre computation. I take this G to the K, no problem, mod P, and then I take that mod Q. Now, most of the time, if I take something mod P and then mod Q, I get nonsense. You know, this is the remainder when divided by this, now being divided by something else. The structural properties fall apart in most cases. But because of the way P and Q are related here, that P is one more than a multiple of Q, and other details of this, you actually get something sensible with this. You do that computation, you do this computation, you compute this value S, and the pair R and S supposedly form a signature on the message. Okay, so you do these two relatively simple computations. This one requires a division. That's why it's important to be able to do division. But still relatively simple computations. And you get a signature. Okay, what do you do with the signature? Well, how do you verify this? You can take this, you first compute the inverse of S. Again, it's a division. Mod Q here. You compute A, which is this value you just computed, times the message. Again, mod Q. You compute this other value from R and W. You compute V, which is again one of these funny things where you do it mod P, and then you do it mod Q. And then, if it all works, V should equal R. Now, I'm not going to go through this. This is one to go through on your own if you feel a need to. DSA is widely used, but not nearly as widely used as RSA.
Josh, I noticed, like in .NET, I think you can sign and encrypt with RSA, but you can only sign with DSA. So does that mean that DSA doesn't have the same properties?
DSA is very different. It's not symmetric in the sense of you can't encrypt with it. DSA is a signature-only algorithm, and it's a bizarre thing. You know, it's not raise it to a power, you're done, like RSA is. It's a whole sequence of rather kludgy-looking steps. The main reason for its existence is intellectual property rights. However, it does have some advantages in that most of the computation is mod Q, and Q is a small prime. These are all mod Qs, and Q is only 160 bits. So a lot of the computation is simpler.
Hey, Josh?
Yes?
You said that, I'm going to just throw in a comment here. It wasn't just the IP right? It was also the fact that it was asymmetric, and you had the whole export thing going on.
Yes. Brian is absolutely right here. Yes. One of the issues, thanks for mentioning it, there was a whole big to-do, let's say, for years and years about exporting cryptography. RSA is not that difficult to understand. It's not that difficult to implement. But, we can't export it. We can export the ideas, the mathematics, but code to do it? No. That would be bad to export. So one of the reasons for DSA was explicitly, as you mentioned, it can't be used for encryption because there's a lot of uses for signatures, and there are a lot of people who are squeamish about encrypted stuff. Oh, those are secrets. Say, well, but signatures are good. There's not a lot of justification for making signatures hard to obtain and hard to generate. So yes, DSA was specifically designed so that it could only sign, so you could export this, and this had no threat of being used for secrecy purposes. Thank you, Brian. That's an important point.
Related to that, one of the projects I was on bought our RSA encryption from a company in Germany.
Well, we can import it. Importing it's no problem.
When we exported the product without the encryption, then bought the encryption at the source country and put it together there. Right. And then it's not an export.
Yeah, that slowed you right down.
There were bizarre rules 5 years ago 5 years ago, they were finally killed. Finally. A little more than five, maybe five and a half, 6 years ago. But they're just ridiculous, painful, serve no purpose except to make it difficult. And I said they served no purpose. They did serve a purpose. The purpose was not the stated purpose of preventing export. The purpose was, you can't export this, you're not going to build it in to your software, because it's so much of a pain to have this thing that you can't export and you have to deal with separately. You don't want to have separate versions internally and externally. So the effect was that nobody had crypto, because nobody built it in the U.S. anyway, U.S. products, because, you know, it was too much of a pain to do. So we should have by now, we should have 15 years ago, had all of our email encrypted. The technology exists. Right now, you send email over the internet, it's postcards. Anybody along the way can read it. There's no reason why your mail shouldn't be encrypted. But building this product would have run into so many export issues that fine, we just won't bother to encrypt it, we won't do it. And the FBI likes that. The FBI really prefers it that way.
There is also a human factor here. Have you ever tried to send encrypted email to your grandma?
Yes, but that's not inherent. That's because it's been built badly so far. And what we had to do was we had all these bizarre things to deal with exports, and now we're trying to deal with the legacy and stuff things in where they didn't fit and they couldn't. And, you know, we'll get there, but it's been a slow, painful process.
Is TSA currently used today, or is it currently default to RSA?
It is currently used. It's used in a lot of applications. RSA has one enormous advantage, and that is the encryption exponent E can be small, 65537, typically, as I mentioned. When you're doing digital signatures, that's the exponent used for verification. So it means that if you're using RSA, you do as much work to sign it with RSA or DSA. They are comparable in some ways. But the verification of the signature is much, much faster with RSA. Just like the other side of things, with RSA, encryption is very, very fast compared to decryption, because the encryption exponent is small. Okay? We do have time, it looks like, to go through my last topic of the day. I was afraid we wouldn't get to it, but we will. See, we're now up to slide 123. And this is something that a lot of people ask about. Usually before getting asked about identity-based encryption, people ask about this. Elliptic curve encryption. Elliptic curve cryptosystems, ECC. Okay. So we'll explain what they are, and we can, in the remaining time, go through, give an explanation of what they are, how they work, what the advantages are, what the disadvantages are. There's a lot of pressure of, this is the latest, newest, greatest thing, we've got to do it, it uses even more sophisticated, better math. Well, yeah, it might break better, too. RSA has been around for a long time. It uses some very old mathematics. People have been trying to factor for centuries, and we've made some progress, but we still don't know how to do it. The elliptic curve stuff is a little touchier, let's say. But let's talk about this a little bit. So, if we're going to talk about elliptic curve cryptography, the first thing we have to do is talk about elliptic curve. And these things are cool, I'll give you that. They look weird and funky. And so they're a little fun to take a look at. So this is an elliptic curve. Standard form, any elliptic curve is basically a curve that satisfies this equation, two constants, a and b. Y squared equals x cubed plus 3x plus 7. That's an elliptic curve. Plus 29x plus 4 is an elliptic curve. That's all. Okay, pretty simple looking equation. What does it look like? Well, no, it doesn't look like an ellipse, remarkably. What it has to do with ellipses is rather obscure. It's got to do with conic sections, but you don't want to go there, believe me. Okay, so it looks nothing like an ellipse whatsoever. So, to understand what one of these things looks like, I'm going to start off by simplifying it. Because trying to draw this, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe you can use a graphing calculator, but I bet this will screw up most graphing calculators. But I'm going to make one small change. And again, if I hit nice animation to do this, but I'm going to get rid of this and that alone. There. Okay? So.
That's still an elliptic curve.
This is not an elliptic curve. This is a very ordinary cubic equation that you've seen many, many times, I hope, in high school, and since this is a standard cubic equation, it looks basically like this if you grab it. Right? Y equals x cubed. There's no x squared term. There could be an x squared term, but it turns out, you know, it's just as general if you just assume the x squared coefficient is zero. You can always do translations and change the variables to make that true. So, this is what a typical cubic curve looks like. Because the coefficient of x cubed is 1, it's always plus 1, it always starts off at negative infinity, it goes up, it comes down, it goes up again. Now sometimes the come down and goes up sort of flatten out. In the extreme case, they can get pushed right up to each other and there's zero distance between them. So the simplest case, y equals x cubed, it all just collapses. But this is the basic general form. Okay? Now, how many times does this cross the x-axis? Well, 3 times here. 1, 2, 3. Do all such elliptic curves, or does all such cubic curves cross the x-axis only exactly 3 times? It's never more than 3 times, right? There can only be at most 3 roots to this equation. It's only a cubic equation. But they can line up on top of each other, or they can be imaginary. So let me show a few cases. Oh, sorry. No, before I show the few cases, you're right. I ordered this differently than how I remembered. Let's go back to the y squared case. So we know how this one looks. Let's go back and now take a look at what this one looks like. So what I'm going to do is start with this, and I'm going to play with the graph. First of all, when y is positive, this looks more or less the same, stretched out. But y negative can't happen in the same way here. This equation here, we've got y squared coming out. All these values are going to be positive. Y squared is always positive. So the things below the x-axis effectively disappear. But what you've got is something which is symmetric across the x-axis, because plus or minus y both satisfy it. So what you get is effectively something that looks like that when you put it together. Now it's stretched out a little bit because it's y squared instead of y, but it's just taking the square root. You know, it just stretches it a little bit. It still looks kind of like this, okay? In its general form. It's got 2 separate pieces in this form. Now, it doesn't always have 2 separate pieces. If I started out with a cubic down here with 2 imaginary roots over there, then it only crosses the x-axis once. When I do this, cut off everything below and flip, I get just 1 piece. The piece over here is gone. Okay, I just get 1 curve. I guess it sort of goes up like that. Okay? Also, the cubic might have its minima, its local minimum here, above the x-axis, so these 2 roots are imaginary, so it only crosses here, and now look what happens when I cut off and I flip, I get that bizarre object. The 2 parts have melded together somehow. And yes, when there's actually a double root in the original cubic equation, then you get something where it just comes to a point and sort of right around here, say, it comes to a point and then breaks up right there. Those are ugly edge cases that we don't want to consider. Okay. As though these are nice and clean and easy and simple. I told you it's funky. This is a funky curve, and it's a pretty simple equation which led to this rather funky curve. Okay. So, now that you know what an elliptic curve looks like, we'll go on and we'll start talking about elliptic groups. And to understand elliptic groups, we have to look at one other thing. And then what happens when elliptic curves intersect lines, straight lines? So here's an elliptic curve, and I got one in the nice general form, and here's a straight line, y equal ax plus b. I'll ask the question, how many intersection points are there between an elliptic curve and a straight line? Well, I've got two equations here. I can put them together. Here's the first equation, here's the second equation. Substitute for y, I get ax plus b squared now equals this. The y's are gone, I've just got a cubic equation. How many roots does this cubic equation have?
Three.
Well, in the typical case, it's got three roots, but it might be below, it might be that this is pushed down or this is pushed up. I might have just one root. That's not unusual. It is unusual for it to have exactly two roots, but it can have exactly two roots if this gets pushed up right up and just touches the axis, or this touches the axis right there. But that's sort of the skewed boundary case. So the normal cases are one intersection point or three intersection points. The tangent case, where the curve just comes down and just touches tangent to the axis and comes back up, that will give you two intersection points. Okay, so let's look at one other case. That equation I gave, y equal ax plus b for a line, works for all lines except for vertical lines. A vertical line can't be described as y equal ax plus b. A vertical line is just x equals c. It's just one x value. Okay? Well, how do elliptic curves intersect vertical lines? Well, again, this is a simple substitution. X equals c, I substitute this constant, whatever that constant is, in for x, and I get y squared equals a constant cubed plus another constant plus a constant. Y squared is a constant. Well, how many solutions does y squared equal a constant have? Well, if c is positive, it's got 2. If it's negative, it's got 0. And the case when it's exactly 0, it has one solution. So elliptic curves intersecting vertical lines will either have 0 intersection points or 2 in the normal case, never more, and 1 in the boundary tangent case, where it just touches 0. Well, that's a lot of useless trivia, right? Yeah, let's see. Now, what about intersecting parabolas and circles and other things? No, I'm not going to go there. But we can form a group from these properties. Now, how many people here are Redmond Wave 2, if you've taken any course with discrete math and got a little bit of group theory in it? Okay, maybe a quarter to a third. Thanks, John. That's John's PhD, isn't it? So a group is basically just a collection of points and an operation that you can take two points or two objects, you apply this operation and you get another object. And there are a few more properties, associativity, the existence of identity, the existence of inverses, but basically it's a collection of objects and an operation that takes two of those objects and produces another object in that group, not necessarily
distinct. We talked about it last week too.
That's right. You did mention this. That's right. I forgot. Okay. So let's talk about elliptic groups. Again, fancy terminology, but you've got this very nice little property. You take an elliptic curve, and you take a straight line that goes through it, and you take any. If there are two points, there's probably a third point on that intersection, right? So now, if I take two points on an elliptic curve, I can draw a straight line through them. Through any two points is a straight line. And that straight line will probably, except in the screwy cases, intersect the curve at one other point. In fact, if you're not in the tangent case, if the straight line between this and this isn't tangent to the curve, it's going to always hit a third point, and that's it. Well, that's kind of an operation. This point and this point, the operation goes here. But, like I said, they're funky. It doesn't quite do that. What it does is you take this point, and you hit this point, and then you negate it. You flip it over the x-axis. And flipping it actually makes all those other properties of the group work. The associativity and such actually works because of doing this. Okay? It's still, take any 2 points, draw the line, connect, you get that. Okay? That describes most elliptic curve operations. Now, how do you...
So do you keep trying until you get a normal one that has three intersections?
There are almost always normal. If you take...
I'm just wondering, if it's not normal, does that mean you have to scrap it and start over?
No, actually, in some sense, if there are two intersection points, there is always a third. It's just the third might be a double point. If you're tangent, if you're just touching, it's like a double intersection. If a curve is coming up and just touching the line, it's like a double root. So you would count that as 2 points. So if I had a line, and I'm not sure if I can even draw such a thing here, but that came through here and just touched that, then here would be 1 point, here would be another point, and the result, the third point, would be the same point up there again. But you don't have to worry about that, I assure you. You're not going to have to worry about a lot of this. Okay, so let me just give the question of how do you compose a point with itself? How do you, whether you call the operation add or multiply, let's say add, how do you add a point to itself? Well, now we've got this point and this point. Well, what's the line, the straight line that goes through this point and this point?
Which point?
This point and this point.
Two on top of each other.
Right on top of each other, yes. So these 2 points are the same point. And normally you've got to be able to compose an object with itself. If it's well defined, you know, addition, you can add two and two. Just because two and two are the same number, it doesn't mean you're not allowed to add them. So if you've got an operation, it better work on the same point twice. And the way you do it, you can't just say, well, the line that goes through that, because there are lots of lines that go through this. So here you draw the line that is exactly tangent to the curve, and that will go through one other point. So here, let me do it that way. So here, this point composed with itself, added to itself, you go here, here's the intersection, you flip it over and get that. If you'd started here and gone here, then the third point would have been here also, and you would have flipped it over and gotten that. Okay? Now, finally, and we really are almost done, as bizarre as this sounds. We're just getting into the weird stuff. You know, we've been doing the weird stuff for a little while. Let's look at the vertical case. What about this point and this point? There's a vertical line that goes between them. Well, that's not going to intersect anything else, and there's no double root there. What happens there? Well, we're going to throw in an extra point to cover that. It's called the point at infinity. It's off, way off of infinity. You never see it. It's a point at infinity that adds it. An artificial point I is added to this curve, or added to the group that's formed by this curve. And this I actually serves as the identity element for the group. And you can sort of see why it should be the identity element, right? If you start way up here, way off of infinity, and draw a line down through this point, where will it go? Well, it'll go down here, and it'll intersect here, and then you flip it over, and it comes back up to here, because you always flip across the x-axis. So really, it did come back to the start, where it started, where this identity element composed with this point came back to that point, in some sense. You have to use a little bit of creative imagination here, but it all works. Okay, so there's a lot of geometric intuition here. Forget about it. Once you've got all that, you can actually define this algebraically. Algebraically, okay, you take these 2 points, you intersect them, you get the line between them, you compute where it intersects, you flip it, whatever, and it becomes just these equations. This point composed with this point equals this point, where x3, the first coordinate, is defined by this equation, which is what you get by simple geometry. Plug it in. And y3 is that point. Again, plug it in. Compute the slope of the line, like you learned to do in high school, and find the intersection, and find the point, and go on there. So this is how you compose it when the 2 points have different X values to start with. If they have the same X value, then the geometric calculation, when you do it algebraically, comes out like this. As long as the two Y values are not both zero. If they're both zero, you're in another case. But finally, if these two things, if these two points have product I, if X1 equals X2, but Y1 and Y2 are different, or they're both zero. And the identity element serves as an identity exactly the way you'd expect. And by the identity, by anything you get anything. Okay. What's going on here? Why do we care? Forget about the geometry now. You've got a bunch of completely algebraic equations. You don't have to do these over the real numbers anymore. You can do these algebraic equations mod P. Mod N. Mod anything you like. Again, why would you? Well, we'll get to that in just a second. We really are there. So let's go back to our fundamental equation. I'm going to make one change, and I'll explain what this notation is. Instead of saying mod N, I'm going to say in the elliptic group defined by A and B are just the coefficients of the X term and the constant term that of the elliptic curve that defines the group. And P is the modulus that you're doing things over. Okay? So this is an elliptic curve, and you can do all these same operations. You can do multiplication of two points by the definition I gave you. If you can do multiplication of two points, you can do exponentiation. Right? This point times itself is this point squared. This point times itself is this point cubed. You can do exponentiation. You can even use repeated squaring to compute large exponents. Okay? Now, let's look there. Let's look at what we know about this and compare it to the standard mod n case. When z is unknown, you can efficiently use repeated squaring to do this computation. Okay? And we've already talked about that. We don't need to talk about it anymore. When x is unknown, this is a discrete logarithm problem. Just like over the integers mod n, it's a discrete log problem. It's believed to be quite hard. Just like it is over the integers. When y is unknown, it turns out, this is the RSA usage, but it turns out you can compute an analog to the discrete root. You can compute that, although it uses some sophisticated means we won't get into. So, remember the Diffie-Hellman algorithm? Again, we won't go through it in gory detail. These, yes, can be integers here and here. This is exactly what we talked about before, but I left a little bit of room here. Send A, send B, there, there. Well, this is all done mod n. Well, instead, we can do them. Maybe I didn't need that room. Oh, I see what I had. Never mind. I can do the computation over an elliptic group instead of over the integers. Exactly the same algorithm. I'm doing it over an elliptic group instead. RSA doesn't work because we said the RSA equation can be solved, even if you don't know any factors. But Diffie-Hellman still works. And DSA, the digital signature algorithm, well, that still works. It's almost identical to DSA over the integers. Again, you replace the mod P and mod Q with two elliptic groups, EP and EQ. Everything goes from there. Okay, final slides. Why do we care about this? Why would we use it? Well, elliptic curve discrete logarithms, which is what we're talking about, is the problem that's believed to be hard to solve, is harder by current known methods than integer discrete logarithm. For integers right now, we say, if we want to make discrete logarithm hard to solve, those integers better be at least 1024 bits, or close to that. Well, that's because we do know some tricks. We don't know how to do it efficiently, but we can, with a lot of work, do discrete logs on 512-bit integers. Okay? There are what are called sub-exponential algorithms. for elliptic curves, we don't know any sub-exponential algorithms. So 160 bits is enough today, until somebody invents a sub-exponential algorithm, and then it won't be close to enough. But it looks good now. People have been trying for about 15 years, and there's been no success. So you can get away with shorter curves, shorter keys, shorter values. Okay. It's also somewhat faster than traditional integer algorithms. Not because it's simpler. You remember those ugly algebraic computations that we did. But it's faster because we can use much shorter values. And because the values are much shorter, it's a little bit faster. It's much shorter, but you're doing more complicated things. It's a trade-off. You come out a little bit faster. The big advantage is shorter keys, shorter values that you're working with. Okay? Why not use them? What are the disadvantages? Well, the discrete algorithms have been studied far less. There's less certainty about it. It's been shown that they're no stronger than the integer algorithms in a certain sense. If we had a fundamental break in integer algorithms, found how to take discrete log modulo integers really well and efficiently, that would carry over to elliptic curve also. The reverse is not necessarily true. It's possible that we completely break elliptic curves without breaking the integer algorithms. So there's that added little measure of security. And finally, the keys, the computational efficiency, you gain only a little bit because you're doing more complex basic operations. And in order to get any noticeable gain, you really have to push things down close to the edge with elliptic curves, closer than I'm comfortable with most of the time. You have to use some special cases, and there have been a lot of special cases used, and a lot of special cases have been broken, and you know, I get a little bit queasy there. But you know, there are the trade-offs. A lot of people like them. A lot of people talk about them. The U.S. government is about to go into them in a big way, so it's worth knowing about. But basically, it's another group to be working in other than just the integers. RSA doesn't work there, but Diffie-Hellman works there, DSA works there, lots of other things do work there, and there are some advantages to working there. Okay, I think that's pretty much it. Are there any closing questions? Okay, sorry for going over. I will have the homework posted shortly, now I know I've gotten through things.
And I will post some slides to the...
Okay. And thank you.